The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate 2021. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans, war widows and partners right across South Australia. The program is in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch, Christian Teusner from the Emu Tree, and has received funding through the Saluting Their Service Commemorative Grants Program via the Department of Veteran Affairs. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit theemutree.com. Today is the 12th of May, 21. I'm here with Ray Cotton in his home. Ray, thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this program. The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. Could I get you to start off simply by just stating your name, date of birth, and service number, please?
My name is Roman Edward Cotton, and my service number was 19522.
And your date of birth, Ray?
Was 21/08/24.
Could you tell me a little bit about where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Sefton Park in Adelaide. And when I was 2 years old, my mother passed away and I was adopted by an uncle who had a farm about 10 miles from Port Pirie. I worked on the farm, milking cows, driving horses, mustering sheep, until I was approximately 17 years of age and the war had started. And they were building an aerodrome at Port Pirie, and I went to work on the aerodrome putting roofs on my huts, the Air Force huts. And the people I worked for were from Sydney, and I worked with them on the Pirie aerodrome until it was completed pretty well, just putting the roofs on the huts. And then from there I went to Malala, which was the same sort of thing, putting roofs on huts there. And when that was completed, I moved to Adelaide and I was boarding with my auntie. And I started to work in the Islington aircraft factory, building part of the Beaufort bomber. And I was always dead keen on being a pilot in the Air Force. But being colourblind, I passed every test by the colourblind. So they said to me, you can join the ground crew if you want to, but That's the end of that. So I said no. So I went down to Wavell and joined the Army.
What age were you, Ray, when you joined the Army?
18 years and a few months. I joined on the 3rd of May, 43.
How did you feel? Was it exciting? Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't a bit nervous. I was just looking forward to it, more or less. I was disappointed because I couldn't get in the Air Force. In the air crew, but I found out afterwards that being colourblind, you could still join the air crew because any person that was colourblind could distinguish a camouflage. If there was a boat camouflage, the ordinary person couldn't see it as well as a person that was colourblind could see it. So anyway, I joined the Army on about the 3rd of May in 43. And from there, we went to Cowra in New South Wales, where I did my initial training. And then to Dubbo on transit to Brisbane, and then I put in the training depot about 5 or 6 miles or 10 miles east of Brisbane, and I put in 7 weeks there before going up to the Atherton Tablelands to join the division. Well, I put in. I forget the name of the place at Brisbane now where they did the initial training. And anyway, we went from there up to the Tablelands, and after putting in about 7 weeks uphill and downhill at this training post, when I arrived at it, they were all coming back on leave. So I sort of more or less sat in the tent for about 3 or 4 weeks and did nothing except eat condensed milk and peaches. And eventually they all came back from leave. And that was either uphill or downhill, wherever you went. And I put in, I think it was 3 weeks there. And then they wanted you, but in the meantime, when I was at Cowra, I did an intelligence course at Bathurst. And so when I was at Conungra, they called us all out one morning and called out all the names that I knew, but mine wasn't on it. So I said to the sergeant, I said, what goes? I said, my name wasn't on the list. He said, no, he said, you're not required. You're a special person, he said, in the intelligence group. So then they wanted me to put in about 3 weeks training to be an instructor. No way, so I failed that on purpose, more or less. Eventually I went up the Tobolines.
This was, you were 18 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And it was your first time away from South Australia, was
That's
it?
That's right, yeah.
To take a bit of time to settle? Or?
No, it didn't worry me. I was on being on the farm, I was more or less alone. I had no kids to play with or anything. And, you know, being with other people didn't worry me one bit.
If you can just refocus back to your time pre-service, living on the farm up near Port Pirie.
Yep.
What sort of things would you do to entertain yourself there on the property?
Well, we always had dogs on the farm, and I had a little miniature, not a miniature fox, a Jack Russell. And I used to put the little Jack Russell on the horse with me and we used to go fox hunting. And I had a staghound, which was like a kangaroo dog, and a sheep dog. And we used to go, always ride into the wind, and I could smell if there was a fox in the undergrowth, stir him up, and then we'd be into it. And when they bailed the fox, I would let the little Jack Russell off and he'd always go for the throat. That's one thing I used to do. Then I had a 12-gauge shotgun. I used to go duck shooting because on our farm a river used to run, the Broughton River used to run right through our farm. Heavy rain in the hills, it would overflow and flood. And about 2 days later, there'd be wild duck everywhere. Shooting and then I set rabbit traps. I used to go out of a night, camp overnight, set the traps. Bought my first motorbike from the sales of rabbits that I caught. That's when I was about 14, 15 years old.
So what age were you when you first fired a shotgun?
Oh, only about 13, 14, that's all. Old 12 gauge, bit of a kick in the shoulder. But
do you remember that first shot?
I do, yes. I'd shot at some wood pigeons, actually, and killed two or three of them, which I wouldn't do nowadays.
Have you been back up to the farm?
Yes.
Over the years?
Yes, about, I lost my wife in 20 years on this Saturday coming up. And about 5 years before that, we went up back to the farm, the sun drove us up. And we pulled up outside the farmhouse, and it had changed a bit, you know. I hadn't been there for 20 years, more or less. And I knocked on the door and the lady came and I said, she said, what can I do for you? And I said, I used to live here years ago on the farm. So she invited us all in. We made a cup of tea and a yap with them and that was that.
How did that feel to you?
Yeah, that was good. Excellent, yep.
Had the farm changed much over the years?
Well, it had, even the trees had changed. But I'll tell you one thing. Our windmill used to pump the water into a big tank, and then it go from pipes to different troughs along for the cattle and the animals. That used to have to go up on that, used to have a platform. And used to have a weight used to put on it. And that'd change the shape of the blades for the wind. And if you didn't want it to work, you'd take the weight off. And I used to have to go up, put the weight on and off. Because when the tank was full, you'd stop it from working.
Overflowing.
Yeah. Then I used to get up on frosty mornings and milk cows. We had about 15 cows, which we had to milk, you know, pulling the teddies. And I used to drive the plough with a team of 8 horses when I was about 15 or 16. Used to help yoke them up, help my uncle yoke them up, drive them out to where we left the plough, whatever, overnight, harness them all up and away I'd go.
All of these memories, are they very vivid?
Oh, I can remember them, yeah. I can remember the first little dog I ever had. It was a little miniature fox. I called it Thruppence. As a matter of fact, I've got a photo in there of that. And I can remember every dog we had on the farm, I can remember. And the names of the cows and all that, and the horses. Well, there was Peggy, was one of the horses. These are the horses. It was Peggy, Gypsy, Prince, Queenie, Metric. But Peggy was called Peggy because my uncle used to put him in a dray and go into Pirie. We were 10 miles from Pirie. And he used to have a habit of bolting. He wasn't a big horse, but he used to like to bolt. coming home one day, I wasn't with him, but he bowled and coming home. My uncle just got stuck into him. He bowled all the way home, galloped all the way home. It didn't stop him, mate. Oh, hell. There was Sandy, was another horse. And so I was trying to think of the name of the little pony he used to ride. No, that's evaded me, that one.
That's right. This, you're doing well to remember that many.
And the cows were called. There was Whiskey, Blackie, Rainy, Millie. And I got a photo of Millie. I'm riding Millie. And Topsy, Strawberry. That's just a few of them.
Was it pretty hard work for a young man?
Well, I suppose it would have been, but I didn't take much notice of it. The milking cows, that wasn't hard work because I was used to it. Used to warm hands up in the cold weather. And we used to have a little cat called Tom too on the farm. He used to hang around just to squirt the milk into his mouth from the cow. And then we used to have to separate the milk, of course. And then we used to make the cream into butter and take that into Perry and sell it. A pound, a shilling a pound. Then I used to gather the eggs. And on our farm there was a lot of scrub. What they call a ligman bush. I don't think you're familiar with that, but on the River Murray, I think you'll find ligman bush. They're a big bush. They grow about size of half of this, and they're just round. And they grow like a forest, and the rabbits used to live in them and whatnot. And I've got photographs until I was about, 9 or 10. From then on, I've got hardly any photographs. Of course, cameras weren't like they are nowadays. They take 1,000 photos on one camera, and not the old box brownie.
It's too easy now, isn't it?
It is too easy, yeah. We used to go in every Friday shopping in the Peru with a horse and cart, horse and sulky. It was 10 miles, in and out. And,
so how long would that journey take?
Oh, a good hour and a half. I didn't always go in the Peru. Then my uncle bought an old Ford truck, old Ford T, if you remember them, Model T. We used to go in the Peru and he used to give me 2 shillings. And I used to go to the fish and chip shop, buy a piece of fish and chips for that, come back and sit in the truck and eat it. And then I remember you used to be able to buy, I used to buy a chocolate that was, I think for Thrips, you could buy it was only an almond, a little chocolate, there was 3 little blocks in the thing. I mean, Bob used to buy one of them. But like I said, I didn't used to go in every Friday. I used to have to stop home and milk the cows. It was actually a pretty hard life on the farm. Nowadays you see these great tractors and harvesters they got, and they just sit there, it's all digitally controlled and God knows what.
As a young man, how did that shape your life, do you think, or your character?
Oh, I think it taught me, to be a loner, I suppose, in one way, being on my own and, not to worry about not mixing with people. And, I suppose it gave me a lot of confidence too to do things.
So who else was on the farm with you?
Only my auntie and uncle, that's all. 3 of us and about 3 dogs and all the cattle and sheep and whatnot, and that was it. I bought a motorbike, as I told you, I sold it. Selling rabbits, I made enough money to buy a 7-pound motorbike, which was a triumph. And I used to go around ride around a hell of a lot around the country on that. It was a 3 horsepower. 50, what they used to call it, like 50 cc's, I think, or 500 cc's, I'm not sure now. Quite powerful, it used to move along. I used to move it along.
Good fun?
Good fun, yeah. I had a mate used to live up the Broughton River about 5 or 6 miles. He had a 2-stroke motorbike. And we used to meet on a Sunday, go for trips around the place. There was a place just out of Perry, or just down from our farm, actually. It's called Port Davis. They had a small jetty. We used to go down there and do a bit of fishing off that.
What would you catch there?
Trumpeters. I catch anything, actually. Whiting, some whiting sometimes. King George whiting, not very often, though. A lot of salmon trout, quite a few fish. And there was our neighbour on another farm. He's only about 3 miles away. He asked me one day to go out with him. He had a boat down there, a small boat, and he made a bomb out of gelignite. He did a bit of fishing with that, and that was in this Port Davis. It was actually where the Port Broughton River used to run into. It was the estuary, sort of. Is it the estuary where it runs into the sea? They used to go out about 3 or 4 miles before it hit the open sea. And he used to go out and throw these bombs overboard and boom, water would go up and it could get quite a few fish. You know, it was effective, oh yeah. Well, even up in the islands, we used to do it with hand grenades. Go out, throw them out, bang, up they'd come.
That's one way of fishing?
That's one way of fishing, yeah. Only ever did it once with him.
It can't have been that safe.
No, well, it wasn't actually, I don't suppose, but you don't think of these things in those days. You used to light a fuse, about this long, just chuck it over the side, boom, that was it. Fuse still used to work underwater, and I remember that. It was a fair old bang.
Now, let me see, you were 18 when you joined the army.
Well, I was 18 and about, well, from August to May. May the 3rd, I joined the army in 43.
Where did you move on to then, after North Queensland? What happened?
Well, we came home on leave from Queensland. It was only for 3 weeks. Well, we did. The battalion had come back by then. And when I went back, we went overseas to New Guinea. Well, it was Melbourne Cup Day when we was getting on the boat at Cairns. And I remember old Riley won it 100-1, I think I remember rightly. I wasn't a betting boy in those days, but I can remember that for some reason. It was on the Katoomba, and I suppose 2 or 3 days before we finished up at Wewak on the north coast of New Guinea. And we were leaving taking over the positions of the one American division, and they were going to the Philippines. We landed there and got settled into our tents and whatnot, and I suppose it would have been about a month later. They flew us down the coast to a certain spot about 60 miles down, and then we walked inland from there for about a day to this village. It was an Angio village, you know. The village is in New Guinea. There used to be a track, just one track, go into the village and all the straw huts and whatever, and another track going out the other side, and that was it. Then we landed at this place, and then we used to go out and patrols from there. The Japanese, they were isolated. There was a lot of them around, but they were all isolated in pockets. And we used to go out and patrols, and there might be a hill with Japanese dug in on it sort of thing, you know. We'd have to try and get rid of them. But anyway, this particular spot we're at, they're all of the names. I got maps and that of it. And at Wewak were three Beaufort squadrons, 7, 8 and 100. And when we used to, our commander, our battalion, there was the 5th, 6th and 7th battalions. They're all scattered like different spots throughout the hills. And if the commander wanted a bomb attack, they used to send down a mortar bomb, smoke bomb. And the Beauforts had come in, they'd bomb that smoke. Well, this particular day, this captain of ours, he's a bit of a nut. He decided to fire a smoke bomb down the track in case there was any Japs coming in. You see, this was nothing to do with the Beaufort bombers. He just wanted to know, you know, get a spot for the Ren gunner to line up and all that sort of thing. They fired the smoke bomb down the track. 3 Beauforts appear. They come over, and luckily they bombed where the smoke was, and no one got hurt. But that's just how things can happen.
It was a bit too close for comfort.
It was a bit close for comfort. I went for oil, but every hole was filled up with blokes. That was one experience I had. But I used to do a lot up there. We used to be in the mountains for about a couple of months at a time. And then we'd go back to the beach for a spell, back to Wewak. And as I told you, I was mad keen on being a pilot in the Air Force at a flight. So I used to go out to the airstrip, Tadji airstrip, and I'd go along and see the Beauforts, they're all lined up, and big mechanics working on certain ones, or they'd be loading bombs or something. And I'd say, which one, any of these going up on a raid or something? He said, yeah, a couple over there. So I'd go, I said, how long before? He said, should be any minute. So I'd go and wait, the crew would come along on the Jeep, hop out. I think there was 5 on the Beaufort bomber, and I'd say to the pilot, I said, any chance of getting a ride? Yeah, he said, hop on. He said, we can take you. So I had about 4 or 5 trips with them, going out, loading bombs and that. And it was, of course, there was no enemy aircraft then in that stage. They'd all been shot to bits and whatnot. And
what was that like for you? How did you feel? Was that, it must have been
very exciting. I used to love it. Now I wouldn't go up and play if you asked me. No, I used to love it. I used to go up and another player, the old Douglases, the DC-7s, they used to go out, Kai bombers they used to call them. They used to go out dropping food with in parachutes, you know, and just kick it out. And I used to have trips with them as well, the old Kai bombers. But you used to fly through the mountains, the Alexander Ranges, they were called, Prince Alexander. They used to, and you'd see the mountains on each side of you as you flew through, you know. And didn't worry me, not a bit. Then we used to go back into the mountains again, into the hills, and do more patrols. Well, there was a couple of our blokes got killed. Accident, friendly fire, actually.
Really?
One of them. He's killed by our Bren gunner. It wasn't my platoon. I was in the 14th platoon. It was 13, 14 and 15 in the company. And they were in 15, I think it was. And they were on patrol, and there was kunai grass, which grows about 5 feet high. It's like bamboo, only not as hard as bamboo. And they were going through this path, evidently, and this Bren gunner, he was back of the section, and he heard this noise up in the kunai, and he opened fire. And he killed one guy and shot the other bloke through the leg, and he lost his leg. I got photos of that. As it happens, I had photos of two of them with another guy. But I was always keen to go out and patrol when I first got up there. But have you ever been on a rifle range?
Yeah.
With a 303? It's strange. You hear a bang and a thump when the bullet goes overhead. Bang, thump. The first patrol I was ever on was, I don't know how many nips are dug in this village. But our Corporal Dempsey, he was a mad shit. He used to sing out, "You effing something so and so and so and so," you know. And I'd think, Christ's sake, shut up. They'll know where we are. But that's the first time I ever had that wasn't a 303 from them, it was some other one. But yeah, there's bang and thump and that. So I quietened down a bit after that. But that was my first experience. And anyway, towards the end of the war, our whole battalion was going to do a forced march from about 30 miles inland to Idaho, which was about 100 miles down the coast from Wingwack. And our platoon of our battalion were to lead the forced march, sort of thing. And the first night we were camped on this fairly high bank on this river. The river was dry, actually, but it was a water course. And I said to Corporal Tim, I said, "We're going to dig in here." And he said, "No." He said, "We'll be right." And we're all lying down on this stretch of bank, about 70 or 80 guys, and it was about, we got there, I think about, it would have been about 11 o'clock in the morning. We're going to stop there for the night, the rest of the battalion behind. And anyway, about sometime in the afternoon, we hear this noise, and then this little Jap's walking along with a pack on his back and everything. The corporal, he had a machine, Owen gun, which was a light machine gun, and he opened fire on him. But having a pack on his back, he didn't kill him, evidently. So anyway, it was finished up. We got about three or four of them scattered around. They didn't know where we were. So we finished up. And from there on, we marched to about 10 miles from Wee-Wack. And there was an airstrip there that the natives had built through the, they'd leveled it off pretty well, you know. It was a big kunai strip. And the planes used to land there, and we were dug in on this particular place. We heard that the war might be, you know, due to be finished. And anyway, I think it was 13 platoon went on patrol. We were pretty high up in this village, dug in there, but just walking around sort of thing. And there was Japs in this little village. One of our blokes got shot, not like in our company, another platoon. And he'd been to the Middle East, up to New Guinea, back again and up again. This was a week before the war finished and he gets killed. Corporal Way, I remember his name. I just often have a yak with him. And another little bloke, he was lying down, he got a bullet hit him in the, he was lying down with his, naturally his legs out behind, and the bullet hit him in the muscle on the back of the leg, split the muscle open like a knife cut. I struck him after the war finished in Melbourne. We went over there on Anzac Day. He was a Victorian, and I struck him. So eventually we finished up, we got into WEWAC, because this is after the war had finished, of course. And I skipped a bit there because the Japs surrendered to our company, Jap General there. I've got to look at all that there. That's when we dug in this place where this bloke got shot. Well, we were told, there was a section of us out of our platoon, we want you, the Japanese general we know is going to be coming in any minute sort of thing. So we were all prepared, it was about 10 of us, and eventually the same village that was down below us, this guy, well there was about 10 of them all again, they had this bloody great white flag. So eventually we went down the hill and waited for them to come up. And one of them started to talk to us. He swear to God it was an American. He'd been educated in Canada. he was the old general's right-hand man. And he was the interpreter, of course. Hank the Yank, we used to call him afterwards. And because I struck him, they had a big prisoner of war camp in WEWAC after that. And I used to strike him and I used to talk to him quite a lot. He's quite a, well, I used to say he's a nice bloke, but he's still a bloody Japanese. Anyway, that was okay. So they took him on, they're going to fly him out from there on this airstrip they'd built, I was telling you about. And when they went to a village, they used to make him get off and walk through, so the natives would think, oh, if they carried him through, they'd think he was still a boss, big boss man, you know. So they used to make him get off and walk. So eventually they flew him out to WEWAC, and that's where he surrendered.
Do you remember the moment you heard the news?
Yeah, I do, yes. Our sergeant told us. We all said, whoopee, you doing throw hats in there, sort of thing. No, I don't, it didn't, we didn't, we were just happy to know that it was over, more or less. There's no big celebration or anything. I was 21, actually, at that stage, in that same camp, turned 21. And I remember one of the lads got the cook to make a cake for me.
Did you often think about life after the war?
No, to be quite honest, never used to give that a thought, what it was going to be like after the war, I don't think. No, never used to. I think you got to the stage, you know, you used to just play things by ear, more or less. No, I didn't give that a thought.
So how much longer were you up in New Guinea?
Those that were in the Middle East and been to New Guinea before, they had used to go by what they call points. And if you had a certain amount of points, you were first to come home. Well, naturally, I didn't have many points because that was my first trip with them. So they called us out in parade one day and said about the occupation force in Japan. Anyone volunteer to go to that? Put their hand up with about another 40. But we were there for about 3 weeks, nothing happened. So I thought, oh, bugger this, I think I'd like to go home. So the next thing they call us out and pray and said, all those that don't want to go to Japan in the occupation force fall out. I thought, this is good, I'll be going home. But I wasn't, I was sent to Rabaul. There was a platoon of us went to Rabaul to guard the Japs over there. There was two prison camps in Rabaul. There was 100,000 Japs in them, in the two camps. Wow. They'd been bypassed by the Yanks, Americans. And they couldn't do anything, they were just there. So they were in camps there, and we were sent to guard them. And that's all we did for the whole time we were there in Rabaul.
And what would a daily kind of...
We used to get up as same sort of routine, get up a certain time, you know, reveille and all that. And then we used to have to march down, because they wouldn't just walk down in front of the Japanese. We had to march, you know, and that sort of thing. And those who were going to go down, there was only about two of us at a time on each thing, on each compound. And they'd just start marches down there, and then we'd just walk around, march around the compound, or walk around, and we talked to the Japs more than anything, and that was our day's work. Another occupation that we did in Rabaul is to get a truck, a Japanese truck, a Jap driver, and a couple of Japs on the back, and one of us with an own gun. And they dragged miles of caves in Rabaul, at least they have ammunition in there, aerial bombs, God knows what, but the caves were about 300 or 400 yards long. And our job was to pull up at the mouth of these caves. They'd go in and bring the ammo out, load it on the truck, and then we used to go around to the harbour, put it on a barge, and they'd take it out the middle of the harbour and whoosh, overboard. And if you went to Rabaul, and now you'd still find tons and tons of bombs in Narrabool Harbour, because it was hundreds of feet deep, I think, Narrabool Harbour. They'd still be there today, a lot of that.
So at this point in time, you're still 21 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
How much longer were you stationed up there?
At Rabaul, I was there until... We were up there for about, in Rabaul, I suppose, for about 9 or 10 months. Yeah, sometime in 46 when we came home. Then we came home on the Manura, sailed into Sydney Harbour.
How did that feel, the first sights of the
That region? Was a bit exhilarating, once we started to see a bit of, you know, a bit of our own territory. And then we got off the Manura, and we got pretty well on just about straight away onto a train. And because we headed down, I forget whether we had to change trains at Albury. You don't, now you go straight through, I think it's all one goes, but we just have to change trains at Albury, hopped on a train there, and the next thing we didn't change at Melbourne, we went into Melbourne, back out home to Adelaide.
Was that an emotional time for you, returning back to South Australia?
It was, yeah, that was pretty emotional, because I was engaged to a girl, actually, when I went back to New Guinea. She was at the railway station with an auntie of mine. As a matter of fact, it was the auntie I used to board with when I was working at the aircraft factory. I can remember my auntie saying, what have they done to you? Because I was yellow, taken out of it for the fever you used to get. This used to turn you yellow. She said, what have they done to you? So anyway, I hopped on the tram, went out to Wavell, had a shower, and that changed into another cover, and then went out back to North Adelaide where my auntie was. Had a couple of kisses and whatnot. So I stopped there for about 2 or 3 days. And my auntie used to keep house for on the Connell Street. You know Connell Street at North Adelaide? Well, on the corner, I think it was 10th Street. And the Connell Street had a second-hand furniture shop. And he had a 1946?
46.
No, he would have had a 30-something Chev. And we went to Port Broughton and that. And the people in the meantime had sold the farm. They had a hotel at Port Broughton. So we went up there, and they wanted me to be barman. Then I wasn't too keen on it, but eventually I did. But in the meantime, I stopped taking Adderall, and I got malaria. I finished up in the hospital. But as it happened, at that stage, they'd found a cure for it, a little pill. And I took that, and that was the only attack I ever had. So I was right from there, and I finished up barman there. Drunk slaver for 46 until 49. I used to hate bloody doing it too, actually. And
the Port Broughton Hotel?
That's when I bought the motorbike there. The Port Broughton Hotel, yeah, it's Port Broughton. As a matter of fact, my auntie's father built it. If you go up to this day, there's a stone out the front built by W.U. Wall. They sold the hotel in 49, and I got married in 1949. I flew to Melbourne on our honeymoon, came back, and they'd sold the hotel, and I thought, well, that's nice, I got no job. But the PMG had two blokes there that used to go out running wires on the lines and that, you know, and installing phones. So I got a job with that on the PMG. And I did a few schools, used to come to Adelaide and do cable schools and that sort of thing, working, you know, joining cables. So I was with the PMG until about 1966, I think it was. I transferred to Adelaide, and I finished up in a depot at Mary Street in Unley, and I did like cable joining. And I remember the cables in Port Broughton about as thick as your finger. That's all about 20 pairs of wires in them, you know. And when they opened the lids on these manholes down, here's these bloody great cables. Be a bit lost here. Anyway, I got the hang of it, and I finished up. I started as a cable joiner, and I worked way up. I became line foreman to inspector. I finished up inspector when I retired in 1984.
PMG,
oh, no, I was PMG. Then I went to Telecom, and Telstra, I didn't arrive there. That was after Telecom. Yeah, I had 37 years just about with PMG and Telecom. But I've been retired nearly as long as I worked for them. So there you go. From 84 to now, that's 94, 104, 14. That's 37 years. When I retired, I thought, I wonder if I'll get to 2,000 years.
So you were 60 when you retired?
60, yep. I was 60 in August and I retired in September. Some chaps retired a day and they bloody die the next week, you know, they do. Well, when I was in Port Broughton, they used to hold dances in the local hall, which every country town did. Once, it was on a Saturday generally, and I saw this young piece in the hall one night. It was always at night, you know, a dance. So I plucked up courage after drinking about half a bottle of dry sherry. I plucked up courage, you know, to ask her for a dance. Yeah, it was all right. So I got to know her and knew her for quite a few months. And I used to go out to the farm and have tea with them. Eventually we got engaged and got married. And that was it. We were married in the old church in Port Broughton.
What was your wife's name, Ray?
Val. Valda. Valda Hazel. Arvin. She used to hate Hazel. She used to call her Val.
Family? How many children?
Only two.
Did you have?
Philip, Phil, and one next door here. Michael. He's the youngest one. They're all heading to 70, but he's the youngest. He was in the army and the other one was in the Air Force, Philip. And out of those two, Philip had two boys. They got married and they've both got three girls and a boy each. Michael has got three girls. One's got two boys, one's got two girls, the other one's got two boys and a girl. So I've got a few grandkids hanging around.
They keep you busy.
Well, great-grandkids, yeah, and great-grandkids, yeah. Yeah, see quite a lot of them, actually.
So you're 37 years retired now.
Yep.
How do you fill your time? What have you been doing for the last 37 years?
Oh, God. At the moment, I keep myself busy. I do a lot of crossword puzzles. And I don't put the television on until I've got three televisions, one there, one in there, and I got one just put on for Fox. I don't put them on until about 3 o'clock. I watch The Chase most of the time, you know. And then I go to the pokies. I used to go to the pokies quite a bit. And visit a lot of the old guys I used to work with and that sort of thing. Oh, and in the garden and mucking around, cleaning out cupboards. I keep busy. My leg's holding me back a bit lately, my ankle. That's bugger of a thing. And I've got a little hound dog, he's a little chihuahua. He's in next door.
Was that him barking earlier? I could hear it.
Yeah, that'd be him, yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be him barking. That's why I put him in there. Because a lot of people that he gets, once he sees you bark, then he'll get used to it, he won't bark. But the chap that brought that stuff this morning, the meals, because he's got that yellow thing on, I think stirs him up and he bark the whole time he's here.
Pretty mobile, you drive?
No, I still drive, see, for miles. But my eyesight, I had to check the other day, it's 18-20 on it. For distance, I wear glasses to read and that's all. My appetite's good. I like a little drinky now and then. No, I keep busy.
97 years of age now. What do you think have been some of the most amazing changes in your lifetime?
Oh, the most amazing changes would be telephones, iPads, that's one of them. And, hell. Well, I suppose putting a man on the moon would be one. And different medical science, different things they found cures for and that.
Have you done much travelling?
No, not a great deal of travelling, no. I've been to every capital city, but not to Perth. But I haven't been overseas. I haven't even been to Kangaroo Island. But I'm going to go to Kangaroo Island, all being well. You want your own car, just tour around.
Catch some flathead off the beach.
And not to be sneezed at either. That's what I used to do in Broughton. You haven't got that down there. I used to go fishing. Made of mine out of boat. I used to borrow it. Go out from out the channel. Used to follow a channel out for about 3 or 4 miles into the deep water. You throw a line over and you get about, if you had five hooks on, you'd get five little snapper, little baby ones. So they put a ban on snapper fishing at the moment, haven't they? So,
that's right.
But there must have been millions in this on the channel up there in the Gulf. And then another spot, there used to be a canal running to what called Fisherman's Bay. You go around the coast a bit and there's all these shacks built. It's called Fisherman's Bay. And there used to be a canal run from the main channel right around there, and there's a barge sunk there. And you'd go there over when the snapper are around, the big ones, you go there early morning and get the big snapper whoppers. And there was another place on the main channel, was a rocky outcrop. You go there just on sundown and you get them this big. Not the big ones, but the, you know, all different sizes. And there used to be a mob come up from Muda, net fishermen they were, and they'd come up at a certain time of the year and they'd watch the flats where this channel used to run out. And they'd get to know, as soon as the snapper got out on the flats, they'd ring them. They used to get bloody tons. Great whopping things they were, but they knew all about, you know, what to do. And then they used to bring them into Broughton. There was a guy who used to come, I forget who, they'd come from Adelaide. He used to buy the fish, and he'd buy rabbits. We used to go out spotlight when I was with PMG up there. We used to go spotlight shooting with rabbits. We used to get up to 100 pair of a night, rabbits. The guy used to have a ute we used to travel in. I had the spotlight, another guy had the rifle, and the poor bloody rabbit would pull up and he'd just squat, you know, and bang through there. And the bloke that was driving, he was an ex, he used to do a lot of rabbiting. And he used to just get one rabbit, put a slit in its in the hind leg in the muscle, put the other leg of the other rabbit through and hang him on the fence. This is when we had a few, you see, say 40 or 50. And then we'd go out, keep on going around shooting, then we'd come back and pick them all up. Take them home, the next day this guy used to come around and pick them up, about 20 cents each. Now you pay about 10 bucks for a rabbit, I believe. He used to just go and get the knife. He had an extra sharp knife. He'd go straight down, put the fingers in, pull the guts out, then put the legs together and hang them over the fence. And that's how they used to keep them that way. Didn't skin them, just sold them skin and all. When I was on the farm, I used to do a lot of rabbit trapping. And I told you, I bought my first motorbike with the rabbits. I used to skin them and take them into Port Pirie and sell them. And used to hang put the skins on it. We used to out of a piece of wire, used to make a U-shape, pull the skin over it, hang them up and they'd dry, you know, take them off there. And when you got enough, you'd take them into Pirie and sell the skins. And so I was a real millionaire.
Might be a good opportunity, perhaps, Ray, to have a look at some of your photos.
Okie dokie.
Would that be okay?
That'd be quite all right. Yeah, would you like a cuppa?
I would love a cuppa, actually. I'll just see stop. I'll stop this. So, wow, so you were talking, WEWAC, you were talking about the surrender. Here's a photograph of the surrender.
That's right, yeah.
So who actually took that photograph? You weren't there, were you?
No, to be honest, I don't know who took it. I just got it from some guy and he'd got it from someone else and that's how I come to get them. No, we were still inland, about 20 mile inland when that was done. So like I said, there was an airstrip where we finished up and they flew that old guy out and it's... And they flew us out to finish up. We flew us out from the airstrip to where we went. That flag that I'm holding there, that Japanese flag, I had that in a little case with other souvenirs, silk drawings we used to get off the dead ones up there, and bloody the silverfish got into it, ruined it. But the Japanese, they used to cut, well, they were a man on Parker pens. They used to often have a Parker pen in their whatever, you know, their swags and that. And watches, they all have watches. MacArthur.
General MacArthur.
Yeah, he was the head of Sarong, the American forces in that stage, yeah. New Guinea was one. The Japs couldn't do anything there. There was no supplies. They were just inland. There was quite a few. I forget how many Japs were in New Guinea. They were all isolated everywhere, you know, like I was saying, a village here and a village there. And then Rabaul was another one. That was cut off. Nearly all the islands were, you know. As a matter of fact, years after the war finished, there was odd Japanese on those islands that still didn't know the war had finished, so they reckon.
That's a big boat.
That's the one we came home on.
Wow.
The manure. And we did our barge landings at Cairns off that same boat. Yeah. We used to climb down the side on rope ladders onto the barges and into the fjord. A lot of things. I can remember that photo there, sitting on that box, that dog. I can remember that, so it was yesterday. That one, yeah, I can remember that, so it was yesterday. And I can remember this. So anyway, you can remember things years and years and years ago, but yesterday you can't remember. Yeah, oh, you know, that's definitely me there. Yeah, it would have been about 7 or something like that, I think. See the bloody old horses, no tractors.
It's so much harder getting jobs done with the horsepower.
Yeah. Well, we used to have to feed them before we went to bed, and then get up in the morning, feed them, harness them, drive them out to the tractor or the plough or combine or whatever and yoke them up. And
were you ever bitten or kicked?
No, never bitten or kicked.
So that was you, the 14th platoon?
That would be, I should imagine, yeah, that was 14th platoon, I think, yeah.
For Anzac Day, did you get down to Blackwood?
Yeah, I got to Blackwood this year, yeah. Had a good view of everything up there, yeah. I went down and had a couple of drinkies at the club. And I don't know many at the club, actually. It's the first, I've been up there and had a meal at night, but that's the first time I've ever, second time I've been up there. Good meal, yeah, excellent, I recommend them. Did I tell you about the guy that got shot and his mate was out on patrol one day and they'd pass this, the Japs used to they used to always bury their dead with their head sticking out in one of their foxholes, you know, and stick them in there and leave their head sticking out. Well, they went past his foxhole and one of these little bastards was in the foxhole, and as they went past, he was at the back of the section and he got shot and killed. That's how unlucky he can be. And those Beaufort bombers I was telling you about, after the war finished, they were flying around all over where we were in New Guinea, and they were dropping pamphlets for these Japs that were there to tell them that the war was finished.
Mm-hmm.
One of them flew into the side of a hill, killed four of them, or five of them on the plane. And that was after the war had finished. There's a photo when I was in Cairn, that was training unit. I think it was a competition, actually, each platoon against, you know, marching and that sort of thing. Can you pick me out there? Our names, I think, are on the bottom, our names anyway, aren't they?
I'll try not to look at the names.
Probably wouldn't recognise any. Best looking bloke there, actually. Yeah, that's the bloke. That's the fella.
Okay, you're turning 97 in August. If you could give a piece of advice to younger generations today about life, what would you say?
I would tell them to talk to their parents about times gone by and the difference between those times and today's times. I'll tell you what I said at my 90th birthday when I made a speech. I said, I never drank or smoked and I tell lies. And I said, I'd never go out with fast women. I don't know what I could tell the kids these days. They'd tell me, I think. No, I know what I would like to tell them, to put down their iPads and their phones and communicate more. Because you walk into a doctor's surgery, for instance, there might be 10 people in there or more on the phone. So I reckon that's... I mean, admittedly, the modern phone's an asset in a certain way, but I think it's... to go back to the old type, I reckon, is better. I say that to my son, he said, yeah, bloody old-fashioned. that's what I'd say. Listen to your parents, take notice of them, and just do the right thing by life.
Ray Cotton, thank you very much for allowing me into your home and to share stories and life experiences with me today. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Christian. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure's all mine, Ray.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2021.